Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center.
What I suppose they have in common is the idea of the individual as witness to history. The kinds of things I'm dealing with, although they may have these elements, are not so concerned with the inner life of the individual, but with history, current events.
See, when I write my novel, I don't feel a responsibility, a didactic responsibility. I think that would really hamper my writing if I would feel that. You know, it would make my writing much more didactic than it should be. And the danger would be that it would become lifeless.
German literary culture from the 17th century through the contemporary novel, this week on Soundings. My guests are Lynn Tatlock of Washington University and the novelist Fred Vibon. First on this edition of Soundings, Lynn Tatlock discusses German fiction in the 17th century. Following that, Fred Vibon discusses his novel, The Stain, a narrative of post-World War II Germany and the modern counterculture. According to Lynn Tatlock, the blurring of the line between fact and fiction is not limited to modern writers, such as Truman Capote and Norman Mailer. Lynn Tatlock's study of what she calls the rhetoric of fact in 17th century German literature is a case in point. Here is Lynn Tatlock.
I think first we have to think about what fact is. When I talk about fact, I have a 20th century understanding of fact. That is something that is commonly believed to have actually happened or is commonly believed to be the case.
Are you talking about science, for instance?
Well, that's one area in which people talk about facts. So in science, one might talk about empirical data as fact. Or in theology, a Bible verse might be considered a fact. It depends, of course, on what kind of theology we're talking about. But say to a fundamentalist, the world was created in 7 days. That is fact.
Sure, the fact that it's on the page there in front of you makes it a fact.
Right, but it's also that it's commonly, this particular community believes that it is true.
Mm-hmm.
In the 17th century, there seems to be a protracted discussion about what is true and what is false.
Mm-hmm.
And this is occurring in many different areas.
Nothing new in that.
Right. There certainly isn't. this is very much tied to the discussion of the 80s, I suppose. So in philosophy, there's a discussion about how an epistemological discussion in science, a reevaluation of the classical texts are having natural histories. History seems to loom very large as an authority in the 17th century. There's already some talk about Bible as history and why this might be important. Now, the novel's born in the 17th century, as far as German literature is concerned, and it tries to participate in this discussion.
Sure, and it would look upon this discussion and take from it a kind of a model and an influence in its notion of what is factual.
Certainly in its notion of what is factual, but also the novel has to make a case for itself as something that is worth being read, worth being bought. One of the more famous tracts actually is at the end of the century, 1698, but various members of the church, Protestants and Catholic, began to talk about the novel as something which will corrupt the morals of the young, mm-hmm. and which tells lies, gives you information which is not true.
Is that because, let's pause on that for a moment, Lynn Tatlock. I mean, would the reasoning there be that the novel is suspect because it involves the human imagination? We all live in a fallen world, that sort of thing. Or is it a specific distrust of a particular writer and a particular ideology? Is it both?
Certainly there is a lot of worry about the imagination in the 17th century.
This is an age of witchcraft, after all.
That's quite true. Specifically, the clergy will say that the young will be aroused by reading the novels and then get into trouble, do things that they shouldn't do. Women, as readers, are particularly endangered because they being the sort of cesspools of lust anyway, would have these thoughts incited and, mm-hmm. and so forth. And it's very interesting because the issue is sort of revolves around vicarious living. The people who are arguing for the novel will say the novel is something one should read because this way people can experience things which they could otherwise not experience. They could visit exotic lands and so forth.
They can also get into trouble.
Right, they can also get into trouble. Mm-hmm. And some of the authors are quite aware of this and play with it. They will make truth claims, and then they will make fun of people who worry about such readers who worry about such things.
We don't want to overlook the possibility of irony in all of
this
fiction.
Right, and certainly one finds that. On the other hand, there are other novels which do heavily rely on information, what we might call facts. Mm-hmm. Now, I really guess I didn't really ever say what I meant by a rhetoric of fact. When I use the term rhetoric, I mean something, obviously trying to persuade, and mm-hmm. this is the issue of authority, trying to persuade readers that the narrator, the voice that is speaking,
can be believed,
and that therefore has the authority to speak. Mm-hmm. It seems that in the 17th century, that if it could be assumed from the beginning that the person was not telling truth in some form or other, be that a spiritual truth or something to do with information about the world, that person did not have the authority to speak, shall we say.
Lynn Tatlock, let me ask you to illustrate the points that you've been making about German fiction. A writer in the 17th century?
Well, I've recently been working on a Hamburg writer whose name is Hoppe, who was involved both in the production of newspapers and novels and what might be called proto-encyclopedias.
Now, we don't want to think of these people as just a novelist and that's all he or she did.
That's it, exactly. This particular character was a freelance writer of sorts, which is a very daring undertaking in the late 17th century.
Still is.
Yes. In any case, he invents a kind of novel. These novels, I should say, were extremely popular. They're very difficult to read now simply because they don't correspond at all to our modern tastes and because much of what is there is so topical.
Uh-huh. Well, what were they about?
Well, they were novels that appeared once a year. And they appeared in four parts, so in the four quarters of the year. And each part had, three sort of sections in it. So in other words, they were sort of like newspapers.
Is this Dickens before Dickens?
Well, not. It's not similar to Dickens because I think with Dickens one thinks of someone out sort of crusading. This person was not a crusader, but he was interested in reporting current events in a novel form.
And yet they were known as fiction. I mean, the consumption was conscious. I'm dealing with fiction here.
Well, not entirely, because on the title page, he advertises that he is reporting historical, anthropological, political, et cetera, information, everything put together in the romanische Weise, the novel form, shall we say. And so he invents rather fantastic plots, people mm-hmm. with very exotic names who are journeying all over Europe and fighting pirates and such. But what he also does is to have these persons have conversations about current events. Now, the conversations, there's no attempt to imitate natural speech, whatever that is, but instead we have what looks like something one might find in a newspaper. In other words, columns of statistics, a document in Latin, or names of those who were killed in the latest battle, this kind of thing.
So in other words, the facts may slip and slide a little bit, but at least you have the redeeming quality of this grand notion of synthesizing human experience. Presenting it, making it believable.
That's interesting because that's exactly what he says, that if one tried to digest all of this information, if it were just sort of put on the table and one had to somehow sift through it and digest it, that would be impossible. But when it is somehow integrated into a plot, then that makes it possible for us to retain it. Now, it sounds silly, and obviously he's saying this because he wants to sell his books. After all, that's how he lives, by getting this publisher, or selling his books to the publisher who then mm-hmm. makes money from them. But in fact, you will find in the 20th century that when discussing popular historians, recently the obituary for Barbara Tuchman in Germany said that her strength was that, unlike the theory obsessed historians, the detail obsessed historians, she was able to narrate history, to put it in a form that made it enjoyable.
No, it doesn't sound silly at all. I mean, you turn the television set on and we have the networks telling us that they are uniquely qualified to tell us about the world. We have the world in front of us in a half an hour. We have a narrator with whom we're supposed to feel comfortable. It is strange, and yet it is not necessarily alien all at the same time.
Right. What I'm after in this project is very much tied to the discussion of the 80s. There's a sense in certain spheres that we may be in the midst of what's been called a paradigm change, a change in our ways of thinking about the world, a change in our notion of what it is possible to know, and the role that language has in mediating the knowable. I think that something similar was going on in the 17th century. One, in a sense, might see the 17th century as the starting point, or as that a paradigm shift was going on in the 17th century, which gave birth to what has been our consciousness for 300 years. What I'm interested in is the way the novel participates in this particular shift, the way in which the novel attempts to acquire a voice in mediating and interpreting the world.
Lynn Tatlock teaches at Washington University. She's at work on a book about the rhetoric of fact in 17th century German literature. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on German literary culture continues. My guest now is Fred Vibon, whose novel, The Stain, was published last year by Storyline Press. The Stain is a narrative of post-World War II Germany and the modern counterculture. Here is Fred Vibon.
The major difference is that we as young Germans had to cope with the Nazi past of the older generation, which the Americans didn't. You at the same time had to cope with the Vietnam War going on at that time. What caused our rebellion, I think, mainly is that still the same people were trying to assert authority over us, mm-hmm. an authority that we didn't want to acknowledge, like most young people try to, of course, rebel against the authority of their parents. But in our special case, we were rebelling against an authority that had proven to be false, that had proven to be totally In our case, we were rebelling against an authority that had proven to be absolutely wrong, that had caused a lot of harm and a lot of mischief, and had been criminal, actually, in many cases.
Well, what could you do in practical terms, or what could have been done, Fred Vivon? I mean, the older generation to apologize is one thing, to express regret and sorrow and remorse. You can't rewrite history. Is that what you're
after?
Well,
the older generation should have pursued very, very strongly to bring those people who were directly involved in murder. And if it was, you know, being at sitting at a desk and signing signing orders, that to bring all these people to trial as vigorously as possible. But the West German system of justice was very reluctant in doing that. They were bringing some people to justice often because of international pressure, but often not because of internal pressure. There was no internal pressure. Actually, the internal pressure was in the opposite direction, saying, let's leave it alone, let's not care, let's not think about it anymore, let's just look at the future.
Yeah, let's forget. The stain that you talk about in the title of your book, Fred Vivon, is it ineradicable? Is it removable? In what way would you approach that metaphorical kind of
Well, many Germans notion? Would have liked to remove it already a long time ago, actually, right after the war. I don't think it should be removed as long as the spirit that's behind it, that permeated it, is around. And that spirit is not gone in my eyes yet.
Let's talk about some of the characters in your novel, The Stain. You have a hero, I guess, a protagonist, whose nickname is Roland Rebel. Is he all rebellion? Is that the only thing that he's about? I thought that you novelists shied away from stereotypical thinking.
No, he's trying to find solutions for himself and for his generation. He's trying to find a way into the future. He's at the same time coping with his personal problems, as you might remember, which he had, you know, which everybody has, and which make the bring the book onto a more human level, I think. And that is, you know, that his marriage has failed, which I think is a common experience for many people. And so on. So that's part of the stain too. He has a personal stain in his in his personal history.
Did you go into the writing of this book, Fred Vivon, with the deliberate notion that the private is a mirror for the public?
Yes, I do that actually with every book I write. And I start out by using autobiographical material, which I then change around, and I use material I get from other people, from experience.
Are you Roland Rebel? Is that
no,
you?
No, not at all.
All right.
In each of my novels, I use a different character, and all these characters are derived from me in a certain way. So they are based on me, but they are not me. I start out with autobiographical material, as I said, but this changes drastically, and in the end, the character I create is not me anymore. Though it certainly carries, or he certainly carries parts of me. He carries part of my story, but it's not my story.
Fred Vivon, let me ask you about a line that you use in this novel, The Stain, a line that has stayed with me. You say something like this: the more that your past expands, the more your future shrinks. That is, the more you think about your past, somehow or other, that affects your future. What have you got in mind with it?
Well, there are several approaches. The one is, of course, the older you get, the shorter your future will be. I mean, that's...
Sure,
that's
just plain chronology.
That's right, in plain chronology. Also, by learning from the past, hopefully, by seeing more what has happened, by having more experiences, you are able to approach the future, hopefully, in a more rational manner.
Yeah, but does it limit your options in the future to understand your past?
Yes, it doesn't. Well, maybe not that, but the past does limit your future, certainly, and your options in the future, simply because you make decisions at every crossroads.
Is it a constraint? Is it a constraint or somehow or other? I mean, is this a positive or a negative thing you're saying about the contemplation of one's past?
I think it's both. Many people, you can see, you know, do feel it as a constraint, especially when they get into their so-called midlife crisis. And I think it's based upon that very strongly, because they see that they have given up certain options, that they had options years ago, but then they came to a crossroads, they made a certain decision, and then they came to the next crossroads, made another decision, and now they are here and there are not that many options open anymore when it comes to jobs, you know, to their lifestyle, to all these things. So the future does shrink for them. Well, I mean, the positive thing is, of course, that you're much securer than you were. Uh-huh. I don't know. Some people might look at that as negative, too.
You could afford not to worry a little right. bit, as a matter of fact. Should we look, Fred Vibon, for Roland Rebel in middle age? Are you going to revive this character?
I doubt it, Sevier. I doubt it.
Have you lost interest in him?
I haven't lost interest in him. I have lost interest in his further development. It became too predictable for me and not ambiguous enough anymore to warrant to really get into the character and play around with him and see where he would take me.
You use a lot of history in this book, The Stain, Fred Vibon. You begin it, for example, creating, recollecting, I'm not sure what the proper word is here, talking about occupation of another sort. You're talking about the Roman occupation of Palestine. And then you move forward in time, a couple of centuries, and you move into the occupied territory of this young man's mind. You have him moving in an occupied territory, which is to say our contemporary Middle East. Talk to me for a few minutes about this notion of an uneasy political relationship.
Well, I think that we to understand the present and the future, and you know, be able to cope with the future, we have to understand the past. And it always puzzles my mind that people make the same mistakes over and over again, and I do too, you know, sure. And that's so amazing to me, that it's very, very hard to, yeah. Though intellectually you might be able to learn from history and you see it clearly, but then to use this in your own case, or even if it's not a personal case, in the political case. Countries make the same mistake over and over again, governments make the same mistakes over and over again, people make the same mistakes over and over again.
Are you afraid that the racism, that the political extremism that you write about as an echo, as a ghost in this novel, which constitutes your title, The Stain, you think that can happen again?
Oh, certainly. And not with the same people. Mm-hmm. I think it's there everywhere. It's in every people. And under certain economical conditions, under certain conditions of leadership too, this can, and political conditions, this can certainly tilt into a very extremist kind of behavior on behalf of people and on behalf of a government and a country. I would say that certain countries are more safeguarded in our world against this than others are.
Is Germany one of them?
I think at the moment West Germany is, yes. Uh-huh. I wouldn't say that it would remain that forever. I wouldn't say that about the United States either, though I think the United States is certainly one of the most safeguarded, if not the most safeguarded country in a democratic respect in the world today.
Well, Fred Vibon, what is the responsibility of the novelist? There's a large and a very serious word. I'm not sure that you think about that as you sit down at your word processor and write your fiction. What is the responsibility of the writer to warn a society, to talk to a society about these dangers?
See, when I write my novel, I don't feel a responsibility, a didactic responsibility. I think that would really hamper my writing if I would feel that. You know, it would mm-hmm. make my writing much more didactic than it should be. And the danger would be that it would become lifeless. And so, though I do think a writer has a responsibility towards society, and I have become more and more aware of that, I still try to keep it out of my mind while I'm writing. I'm trying to be responsible to myself, to my own goals and to my own ambitions, political ambitions, personal ambitions, and to my own ideals, especially. Mm-hmm. But if I would think of the society at large while I'm writing a novel, and do I want to teach people something, I think there would be a great danger that the novel becomes very didactic and boring, actually.
Yeah, you turn yourself into a sort of a cultural journalist
right.
rather than a writer of fiction.
Right. I think Agit Prop is one of the worst ways of approaching people.
Uh-huh.
I think people should try to find their own solutions, though I would like to bring them on their way in finding these solutions. But I cannot really show them their own solutions in the end, because they have a different history from me.
You live your own
yes.
life. Footnote to our conversation, Fred Vibon. If we could incarnate Roland Rebel, the hero of your book, The Stain, and put him in a third microphone, what would he say about this intervening time that has passed between his counterculture and our social circumstances today?
I would say since 14 years have passed since Roland has shown himself last in my novel, that he would be much more cynical even than he is by the end of my novel, much more cynical than I am. And, you know, that's a sign that it's really not autobiographical, because I made him much more cynical than I myself. I think he would be extremely cynical, but he's an artist in this novel. He'd be a very successful artist. He has shown that he's successful already by the end of the novel. He would not care about politics very much at all anymore. Mm. He would have feelings of guilt. He probably would have been married again and divorced again and married again and maybe divorced again and would have, you know, had a succession of problems like that. And I think he would be a very unhappy person now, actually. Uh-huh. Very unhappy, very cynical, very successful artist.
Does he talk to you? A quick footnote to our footnote.
No, he doesn't talk to me. I've left him and he has left me. I left him by the end of the novel. And I was thinking about writing a sequel for a couple of years, but I lost interest in him.
Fred Vibon's novel, The Stain, is a narrative of post-World War II Germany and the modern counterculture. The Stain was published last year by Storyline Press. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 471. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, conversations about political economy in the Roman Empire and the modern world. My guest will include Willem Jongman of Erasmus University and Roy Weintraub and Neil DeMarkey of Duke University. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. The second week in October marks anniversaries for the Great Fire of Chicago and the Peshtigo, Wisconsin Fire, which occurred in 1871. The Chicago Fire caused losses of $200 million. The fire in Peshtigo, Wisconsin, destroyed six counties and killed more than 1,100 people. Happy birthday this week to the White House, the presidential residence in Washington, D.C., whose cornerstone was laid in early October 1792. 17 years earlier, during the second week in October 1775, the Continental Congress authorized the establishment of the American Navy. Birthdays in early October include the American Revolutionary War heroine Molly Pitcher, the British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, the American First Lady Eleanor Roosevelt, and the American leaders Jesse Jackson and Dwight D. Eisenhower. Molly Pitcher, whose real name was Mary Hayes McCauley, was born during the second week in October 1754. Margaret Thatcher in 1925, Eleanor Roosevelt in 1884, Jesse Jackson in 1941, and Dwight D. Eisenhower in 1890. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
German Literary Culture, this week on Soundings. Listen for Lynn Tatlock of Washington University and the novelist Fred Vibon. Lynn Tatlock discusses the rhetoric of fact in 17th century German literature. Fred Vibon discusses his novel, The Stain, a narrative of post-World War II Germany and the modern counterculture. German Literary Culture, this week on Soundings.